Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs, right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emma Watsky, coming to you from Radio Adelaide, here in Tandunya, on the lands of Gunnamina. Our team pays our deepest respect to Elders past, present and emerging. We extend this respect to all First Nations listeners and to the rightful custodians of the lands you're listening in from. And today on the show...
But what we're concerned is that this government instead is saying that coal will operate for decades to come. Now, that would be a disaster for the Great Barrier Reef, but it also would be a disaster for Queensland's economy because coal is becoming less reliable and more expensive.
Queensland could see its largest and oldest coal-fired power station close 6 years earlier than anticipated. So what could these moves indicate for Australia's energy transition? Also, activists who blocked the road to Pine Gap in 2023 in a protest for Palestine have been sentenced to a six-month community correction order, with their case concluding this week. We have all the details. And later...
And through her study, through her deep, deep involvement in the chimpanzee community where she was studying them, she demonstrated these incredible interactions between animals.
Members of the science community reflect on the lasting impact left by renowned primatologist and conservationist Dr. Jane Goodall, who has died at 91. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up, a Senate inquiry into the aged care sector reforms has accused the government of calculated denial of services and rationing of care. During the aged care service delivery inquiry, it was revealed over tens of thousands of older Australians were waiting for a home care package in July. This number was on top of a further 120,000 people waiting to be assessed. Labor announced 40,000 home care packages would be released by the end of the year, but some suggest this staggered approach to care is flawed. Community Radio Network political reporter Noah Seckham has the story.
The final report has 11 recommendations, including calls to immediately address the waitlists, to notify the sector of future home package releases ahead of time, and to continue inquiries until mid next year. Craig Gear is the CEO of the Older Persons Advocacy Network, and he says the inquiry is a welcome acknowledgement of the difficulties in the aged care sector.
Our evidence that we provided very much aligned with what we're hearing from older people and also aligned with what the committee has found and the recommendations they've come up with. We're hearing too much from older people that they are waiting for to get through the first gate, the hurdle that is the assessment system, and then they're waiting for getting to the right level of services. It was good that the committee also identified that there are workforce issues that need to be managed through this process as well. But our position is that no older person should be waiting really more than 30 days to access services that are going to keep them safe, well, in their home, and get them to be able to still connect with the community.
The Coalition and the Crossbench formed an unlikely alliance to get the aged care inquiry up and in applying pressure on the government to release home care packages ahead of time. Considering Labor's said that they're not exactly thrilled with the way the final report came together, does this raise any concerns with you and OPEN?
Look, we recognise that we are in a fiscally constrained environment. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing the best we can to keep older people living at home for as long as they want to. We've spoken to a lot of older people as the Aged Care Act has developed, and that's what they say they predominantly want to do. When the issue of co-payments has come up, we've spoken to a lot of people, and about two-thirds of them said they were willing to pay some co-contribution. Whether the co-contribution system is right and equitable is something that needs to be looked at and managed over time. One of the things we do, though, very much support the government on is that we need to get going with this new Aged Care Act, and it needs to commence on the 1st of November. The reason for that is it brings stronger protections for older people. It will increase the numbers of services that are able to be provided in the community, and it also enshrines the rights of older people into legislation.
Green Senator Penny Allman-Payne chaired the Senate inquiry and says the government's response ignores the needs of older Australians.
The idea that governments continue to create deliberate shortages in the full knowledge that people are going to die while they're waiting is a problem. So I'm quite confident, particularly given that we had majority recommendations as well out of this Senate inquiry, that the government will continue to come under pressure around this. And it's not just going to be about wait lists either. We know that in 30 days' time, 30% of full pensioners, 75% of part pensioners, and many other older Australians are going to be paying additional co-payments for their care, some of them $50 to get help with a shower. We've heard the evidence at the inquiry that that means people are going to have to make choices. Some people are going to choose not to access the care that they need. You know, the government is saying that we can't afford to release more packages. Well, they can't afford not to.
When you're speaking to people about the changes that are coming in, what has been the response?
People are shocked. And I think that's an indictment on the government that has really failed to educate people around what these changes are going to mean for them. A cynic in me would say that, well, you wouldn't want to tell people about things that they're going to be shocked by. I mean, the fact that we're hearing people aren't going to be able to afford care, you can understand why they've tried to keep it hidden in the same way that they've tried to keep the wait list hidden. We can fix this, but it's going to take a government with the political will to do what's necessary to make sure that our parents and our grandparents get the care that they deserve.
While Mr. Geer reluctantly welcomed the delay of the aged care reforms by a few months, he says it has been difficult for many older people to tackle the assessment process.
Gosh, it has been. I mean, while the My Aged Care website has improved, it's still a difficult system to understand and know that you need to go through a number of gateways for eligibility assessment and then access services. But it's what our independent aged care advocates are so great at. We have over 200 advocates across the country, and they provide free, confidential and independent support working with an older person to talk to them about what their needs might be, to help them navigate the system. And then when there's issues with the services they're being provided, to actually raise those with the provider or the Quality and Safety Commission to get those resolved. They're available on 1800 700 600 and really recommend people, if you're having trouble understanding this new system, to reach out to our aged care advocates or go to opan.org.au.
Community Radio Network political reporter Noah Seckham ending that story.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
The scientific community is reflecting on the life of renowned primatologist and conservationist Dr. Jane Goodall, who passed away at 91 years of age, leaving a lasting impact on the world and scientific research. Dr. Goodall was a pioneer in her field, becoming the first person to live with and study wild chimpanzees in Tanzania, despite having little experience at the time. It was here that she focused on understanding animals' individual personality and relationships. Dr. Goodall transformed the way animals were viewed and sparked a global movement for conservation and animal welfare. Ella Panizzolo spoke with Erica Martin, Executive Director of Humane World for Animals Australia, to find out more about Dr. Goodall's influential career.
Dr. Goodall was one of the people who changed the face of conservation. As a young woman, she had no background in science, just a passion, and was able to convince people to support her to go out and studied animals in a groundbreaking way, where she almost became part of the community, and her observations really changed the way fieldwork is done for many, many scientists.
As you mentioned, Dr. Goodall prioritised emphasising individuality between animals' personalities. Do you think this changed the way scientists viewed animals under observation?
I think it's still changing it. Dr. Goodall was certainly one of the first who demonstrated that they have strong bonds, there's relationships, there's communication. She's the first person that ever documented the use of tools by chimpanzees. So she really did change the way that we perceive of animals in terms of their relationship with each other and the world, and their ability to actually feel emotion.
In the press release published by the Humane World for Animals, you say Dr. Goodall's lifelong work as an ethologist and primatologist will forever be seen as pivotal to our understanding of animals and foundational to the advancement of their rights. Would you be able to give us some examples of how she helped with the advancement of animal rights?
I think Jane got people to think differently about animals. I think animals were largely viewed as things at the time that she probably started her work in the 60s. They really were not perceived as complex individuals. And through her study, through her deep, deep involvement in the chimpanzee community where she was studying them, she demonstrated these incredible interactions between animals. And to this day, I think we are still growing and learning more about that. With certain wild animals, I think she certainly changed the face of conservation. And I think she was also equally passionate about trying to change the lives that farm animals need and the recognition that farm animals equally are sentient. And they suffer pain, they suffer from illness, they have emotional bonds with each other, and that we really do need to consider that in all of our dealings with animals.
How do you think young scientists and activists can honour Goodall's legacy in the 21st century environmental crisis?
I think keep going, keep speaking out, and make the individual choices yourself that can actually change the world. I think young people today can walk the talk. You know, think about what you eat, think about where it comes from, view animals as individuals and stand up, make your voice heard. We literally are living at a time of crisis. Our planet is in crisis. And I think young people more than anyone can perhaps make politicians do the things that so desperately need to be done if we're to protect our natural world.
So what direct impact do you believe she had on the practice of science in Australia specifically?
In Australia, you can see that when people are start, you know, wildlife carers will tell you about the individual personalities of the animals they're working with. When they go out and they rescue animals, whether they've been hit by a car or there's been something, a development within the area that's destroyed their habitat. The baby possums they have, the kangaroos they have, are not just a species that needs certain medical attention. They're individuals, and some need different attention to others. And I think that was where it started, was Jane's work and her study. The other area that I think she was amazing is, I think she was a trailblazer for women. You know, there were very, very few women scientists in the world. And now, you know, in Australia and around the world, we're blessed with a large population of women scientists. And I do hope that her legacy will encourage even more women to get out there, to become scientists and to do their part for conservation.
Erica Martin, Executive Director of Humane World for Animals Australia, speaking with Ella Panizzolo. I'm Emma Watsky and you're listening to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs, right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. A huge hello to ACCC in Alice Springs and to our friends at Three Way Radio in Warrnambool and to our listeners in Hobart on Edge Radio. This week, the court case against two activists who blocked the road into Pine Gap, 28 kilometres southwest of Alice Springs, has concluded. Defendants Carmen Robinson and Tommy Walker pleaded not guilty, claiming the US military facility is allegedly participating in crimes against humanity, sentenced to a 6-month community correction order. The Wire's contributor from ACCC, Kate Lyons-Dawson, spoke with Carmen Robinson and barrister John Lawrence about the case and what comes next.
Obviously, I'm disappointed with the outcome handed down by the judge, but to be honest, I'm feeling more energised than ever. I'm feeling more vindicated than ever because what we heard in the court was the expert evidence of Professor Richard Tanter, who's a research professor at the Nautilus Institute and an expert in his field of surveillance and international intelligence. And what we heard from him was, I think, a groundbreaking thing. He gave unequivocal evidence of Pine Gap's participation in the genocide against Palestinian people at the hands of the Israeli occupying forces. And that's something that we haven't heard in those courts before. It was there were facts laid down that weren't questioned by the prosecutor. They weren't contested by the prosecutor. They weren't contested by the judge. And so what I feel is actually quite a triumphant outcome, because we've now broken ground in the courtrooms to be having conversations about genocide and Australia's culpability in that in ways that haven't happened before.
We've previously reported and interviewed people taking part in those ongoing vigils that are being organised by Mbantwa for Palestine. It's showing a general wider community interest is starting to grow again around this facility. How important has that been for you?
In the actions that we've been taking, we're gaining ground on previously gained ground, and we're working on the backs of previous labour, and we're continuing the resistance of previous movements. And the original resistance to that place started with Aranda families who were trying to resist the development of Pine Gap on their lands, which of course ended in the permanent and forced displacement of Aranda families. So this fight has been happening since the late 60s. It's involved huge numbers of people, both Aranda traditional owners' families, other First Nations people, non-Indigenous people. There was, over the time, thousands of people involved in trying to shut that place down.
Now, you mentioned Richard Tanter as being one of the sources of informing your opinion that had made you do that action on the 27th of November. He was allowed to, at one point, give evidence. I might bring you in, John Lawrence, as well here. How important was it to have that as a defence?
Yeah, it was supportive of the actions. What Carmen and Tommy did was they were charged with obstructing the traffic. It's a relatively minor charge in the scheme of things. But their defence to obstructing the traffic, which they admitted doing, was that it was justified. And it was justified on the basis that they were preventing the commission of another offence. And the other offence that was being committed was the commission of war crimes and crimes against humanity, which are offences which are contained in the Commonwealth Criminal Code and which came into law in 2002. When Australia signed up to what is called the Treaty of Rome. The Crown's argument was successful. The judge ruled that he didn't consider it relevant. He didn't give any reasons upon what the basis was for him finding what we said was centrally relevant.
Was that an important point, that no one did contest the actual substance of what he was saying there in court, like both the judge and the prosecutor?
Absolutely. It means that it's, if you like, accepted. The reason that it was excluded was they considered it not relevant to the defence, which is a legal issue. It's not an issue as to the facts and the expertise of what he said. But as it happened, it wasn't the reason why we were found guilty. The reason why we were found guilty was that in their defence, which is a justification, which is that they were preventing another offence, war crimes, they ironically didn't use any force. And the wording of the statute which establishes that defence does include wording that what you do includes the application of force, whatever that might mean in law. And we presented arguments that force doesn't necessarily mean anything physical contact-wise. It can be just taking action to prevent other people doing stuff.
Barrister John Lawrence ending that story by ACCC's Kate Lyons-Dawson. For the full interview, go to our website at thewire.org.au.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
In Environmental advocates have welcomed the prospective early retirement of Queensland's oldest and largest coal power station in Gladstone, with co-owner multinational mining company Rio Tinto flagging potential closure as early as 2029. Queensland Conservation Council say the move is necessary for community certainty, job security and a shift to renewables. The Wire's Sam Giorgio spoke with QCC Director Dave Copeman, who is urging the state government for clarity around planning for the timely closure of other ageing coal power stations in the state.
This closure is good news because it means that Queensland's emissions will go down. We are the highest emitting state in the country, responsible for a quarter of Australia's climate emissions. The fact that privately operated power stations such as the Gladstone Coal Power Station are closing is good news because what it means is that Rio Tinto, who effectively buys the majority of the power from Gladstone Power Station, has a plan to keep producing aluminium and alumina from its smelters and refinery instead of using dirty coal-fired power, using clean, cheaper, more reliable renewable power.
How do you want to see the government respond to this moving forward?
We are concerned that the current Queensland government is letting politics dictate their approach to the energy transition. The previous government had a plan to close all coal-fired power stations by 2035 and replace them with renewables and storage. But what we're concerned is that this government instead is saying that coal will operate for decades to come. Now, that would be a disaster for the Great Barrier Reef, but it also would be a disaster for Queensland's economy because coal is becoming less reliable and more expensive as these power stations age. What we face at the moment is uncertainty, where once every second day, there is a breakdown effectively at a coal unit in Queensland. This is causing chaos in our energy system. It's increasing price. It means we're relying on gas. Prices are higher than they have been, and that's because of gas and coal.
Do you believe the closure is potentially part of a broader change towards green energy, or do you believe it's purely a financial decision?
It's both. Rio have a 50% emissions reduction target by 2030, and they wouldn't be able to meet that if they were still making aluminium with this dirty coal-fired power station. But it's also an economic decision. They know that it's cheaper for them in the future to be procuring the energy they need from power purchase agreements from solar plants and wind plants. We just want governments to make similarly rational decisions when they're changing our energy system instead of letting 1950s politics and of right-wing agendas that are all about pushing fossil fuels out forever for a political reason, which just is madness. And it risks Queensland jobs. And it also means that Queensland will continue to be a barrier to Australia's climate target.
Zach Schofield, organiser at Rising Tide, warns the prospective early closure of Gladstone's coal power station raises some serious questions.
It's my understanding that Rio Tinto has sort of threatened to close the Gladstone coal plant on the basis that, yeah, the performance has been unreliable. I'm from Newcastle and I've seen our local coal-fired energy station, Eraring, threatened to close early explicitly to try and take money away from the taxpayers to subsidise its operation over the next couple of years. This is a common tactic from coal and gas corporations. I think everyone should be really suspicious of when these coal and gas corporations claim to be propping up the Australian economy when in fact they're draining it at the expense of everyday working Australians.
How do you react to this early closure while other projects like gas, oil and coal are being given timeframes from 2040 to 2070.
When our government does talk about the transition to renewables, they're talking domestically, right? It is good to have a domestic transition to renewables because renewables are the cheapest form of energy generation. They don't require millions and millions of dollars of public money to subsidise their ongoing operation the way that coal and gas does. These extended projects to 2040, to 2050, to 2070, they're for export. And so the government doesn't consider them part of our domestic energy emissions production, while we are in fact the world's third largest fossil fuel exporter. It's extraordinarily hypocritical for our government to claim to be taking action on climate at home while fueling fires and floods and famines through our export.
Do you believe the pace that renewables are growing is enough to reach emissions targets by 2035 for Australia?
Look, I think the government is doing a good job to bolster renewable energy products. If they were effectively taxing our coal and gas exports, which currently have some of the lowest export taxes in the developed world. If we were to actually make the folks that are profiteering off the climate crisis pay their fair share to transition Australia domestically, at the moment, that is the coal and gas industry, to the tune of over $17 billion per year of public money going to subsidise their private profits, then we would have billions and billions more dollars to invest in renewables to make sure that we did hit and even exceed our targets.
Organiser at Rising Tide, Zach Schofield, speaking with The Wire's Sam Giorgio. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Emma Watsky from Radio Adelaide here in Tandanya. Stay tuned for tomorrow's show brought to you from 4EB in Brisbane. The Wire is a weekday co-production between 2SER in Gadigal, Sydney, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane and Melbourne. And Radio Adelaide, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can also hop online to check out our stories at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you tomorrow evening on The Wire.